Hello, everyone. I'm Drew.
I'm Bailey.
I'm Lacey.
And we're sarcastic, so let's get sinister.
Lacey's back!
We missed you.
So excited.
Hey, calm down, Mom.
She missed me. Somebody missed me.
You know, Lacey, I know that you didn't listen to last week's episode yet.
But I will.
But Bailey spent a large chunk of it talking so much shit about you. Like, she was saying how she's glad that you're not here. She knows what you're doing. She doesn't approve. Just really nasty stuff. So.
Yeah.
Thank you for the heads up.
You're welcome. I also was talking shit about how, like, you wouldn't listen to the episode and you would totally fail the quiz, which you did.
Yeah.
So that part was accurate.
You didn't give me enough credit. Because I could have passed the quiz.
You could have.
Yeah.
But you didn't.
That's true. But I think that having the low expectation really worked against me. I could feel that you didn't believe in me.
I don't think Drew believed in you either.
No,
yeah,
I
believed that didn't help. You too. That didn't help.
No, I really believed in you. I thought that you would. I'm disappointed that you didn't.
Well,
she's not mad. She's just disappointed.
If I didn't think that you would listen to the episode, why would I take time out of my busy life to create a quiz for you?
So true.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Thank you for believing in me.
You're welcome. I always believe in you. I am the wind beneath your wings.
Wow, you're so positive today.
Yeah.
Do you want to hear something sad?
Oh, okay.
Is it this case?
Yeah.
All right.
You ready?
Is it sadder than last week's?
I'm ready.
In a different... I think scarier?
Okay.
Okay.
Lacey doesn't have any context because, as we just talked about, she didn't listen to last week's episode.
No. I didn't feel the wind until it was too late.
Sorry. I'm just going to tell Lacey just so that she has some context. Okay. Last week, 8 people were shot execution style. Oh. No, they weren't shot execution style. They were executed.
No. Well,
most of them were sleeping in bed. And they were all related to each other.
Okay.
And they left several, I think 4 children without a parent.
Oh.
In the house, too. Aww.
Only, well, 3 of the 4 children were in the houses, and one of them is completely orphaned because both his parents died. But this, I think, is a different level of sad. Less people die, but they were all awake and tortured, so... So, I'm going to tell you guys about the Cheshire home invasion.
Ooh.
Thanks, Lacey.
There was a big pause, and I assumed you were looking for something.
Well, I was going to change the slide so you could look at the people. Jennifer Lynn Hawk Petit was born September 26, 1958, in Morristown, New Jersey. She, her parents, Reverend Richard and Mary Bell Hawk, and her sister Cindy lived in Slippery Rock, PA.
Oh.
Does Slippery Rock have Slippery Rock?
Slippery You're very Rock? Quiet, Bailey. Why are you so quiet?
I don't know. Is that better?
Yes. Jennifer attended Greenville Senior High School, where she was the captain of the drill team, a member of the Thespian Society, and a member of the Homecoming Court. After graduation, she studied nursing at Sharon School of Nursing in Sharon, PA. Did you know that there was a Sharon, PA?
I did not.
But I'm not surprised. Like, I feel like we have, like, really weird named towns. But
it's Sharon.
Okay.
Like our Aunt Sharon.
No, I know that.
No, I know, Lacey. We've talked about how we both have Aunt Sharon's.
Yeah. I just like to make sure that you remember every time.
I remember everything about you.
I feel really in between you two right now. And should I just go? Like, should this be a you guys episode? Or
after earning her degree, she began working at the Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh as a pediatric oncology nurse. It is there that she met Bill in 1981. Why were you making that face?
Because you said a children's oncology nurse, and that's got to be a tough profession.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of blew right past that because I don't like to think about kids with cancer. William. So Jennifer is the blonde there. William is the only man on the slide. William A. Petit Jr. was born September 24th, 1956. I thought it was cool that his birthday is 2 days before Jennifer's. He was born in Southington, Connecticut. His father owned a general store, as well as being on the school board, the town council, and a member of the Republican State Central Committee. After Bill graduated from high school, he earned his undergraduate degree from Dartmouth College in New Hampshire before earning his medical degree from the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. When Jennifer and Bill met, he was a third-year medical student. The two fell in love, and on April 13th, 1985, they were married in Meadville, PA. Bill completed his fellowship in endocrinology at the Yale University School of Medicine, and Jennifer was employed as a pediatric nurse at Strong Memorial Hospital in Rochester, New York, in addition to performing nursing duties in Sarasota, Florida. Jen and Bill continued their medical careers at Yale New Haven Hospital. So, really smart. He went to Dartmouth and then Yale. In 1989, Jennifer became pregnant, and the two welcomed their first daughter, Haley Elizabeth, on October 15th. This same year, Bill opened his own private practice in Plainville, Connecticut, and became the medical director of the Joslin Diabetes Center. In 1994, Bill began serving as the director of public health for Plainville, a position he held for 14 years. The following year, Jennifer and Bill welcomed their second daughter, Michaela Rose, on November 17th. So their birthdays are in September. Haley's is in October, and Michaela's is in November. They're doing birthdays like me.
Yeah.
Once the girls were born, Jennifer began working as a school nurse for a private boarding school, Cheshire Academy. And that was their life. That's what they did. The family of four was happy and they were successful. Jennifer was loving and generous, adored by the students at the private school. She was an active member of her church, directing Sunday school and serving on numerous committees. She loved reading, playing the piano and guitar, and her daughters. Jennifer suffered from
MS.
Yes, multiple sclerosis, but those who knew her say she never complained. Haley graduated high school in June 2007, heading to Dartmouth in the fall.
Ooh!
Lacey, I think you missed it. Her dad, Bill, he graduated from Dartmouth. And then went on to go to, he went to the University of Pitt for medical license, and then he went to Yale for her fellowship.
Oh, impressive.
Mm-hmm. In high school, Haley was a high honor roll student. She graduated cum laude and won a journalism award, as well as the school's award for exceptional community service. She ran cross country and was the captain of her varsity basketball team. She was also elected the head of the athletic association for her school. Outside of school, Haley raised thousands of dollars for Haley's Hope, a cause dedicated to MS research. She was loved and admired by her, for her leadership and compassion. Michaela, affectionately called KK, was set to follow in her sister's footsteps. She, too, was academically inclined, while also showing great enthusiasm for extracurriculars. She loved Harry Potter. She participated in the athletic experience at Miss Porter's school in Farmington and demonstrated her skills in soccer, basketball, and lacrosse. Michaela loved to cook, play the flute, and just be with friends. She planned on continuing her sister's legacy of Haley's Hope, but she planned on renaming it to Michaela's Miracle as soon as Haley left for college. I thought that was funny and, like, very sisterly. What do you think? You agree?
Yeah.
On the evening of... Did Lacey leave forever or is she coming back?
I don't know. God, she's never here anymore.
It's like she's got other things going on and it just feels like...
Are we important? I feel very, like, replaced.
I'll just go through the pictures when she comes back.
Oh.
Don't look at that.
Oh. You showed me it.
It was an accident.
Oh my. It's your slideshow.
It was an accident. Oh, she's back. Is she me? Oh, good.
Yes.
So, on. Did you just get up to change?
No. I was looking in the camera and I was like, I know I put on a Sinister and Sarcastic shirt. What am I wearing now? And I realized it was just below camera range.
You couldn't just, like, look down?
It felt weird.
Someone's upset.
She's getting a diaper change. She doesn't like the wipes.
They're cold. They're
cold.
We got a wipe warmer. She doesn't
You're
like
not
it
supposed
anymore.
To do that!
It's too late. It's been done. Has not made a difference.
No, but like the warmth helps bacteria grow.
No. Oh, well, now we know.
Don't keep them too warm.
Okay.
Also but hold on though. If the wipes are warm, what's she complaining about?
I don't know.
Because they're wet.
Yeah. The whole process is not her favorite.
She just sounds like a little dramatic.
A little high maintenance.
Yeah. Settle down. So. Here comes the important part, Lacey. On the evening of Sunday, July 22nd, 2007, Jennifer and Michaela, mother and daughter, the youngest daughter, went to the grocery store to get food for dinner. Michaela planned to cook for her family that night, and so that's why she went.
Oh. That sounded like a great sentence.
Stop asking questions. That's why she was there. As they shopped at the store, a man at a nearby ATM noticed 11-year-old Michaela and her mother. He followed them out of the store to their nice car, then decided to follow them home. In doing so, he took note of their nice house.
I don't like that he noticed... The 13-year-old, is that what you said?
11. So worse. Oh, okay.
That's, yeah.
Joshua Andrew Komisarjevsky. Just so you know, I'm going to say that name maybe 3 times. He's going to be called Joshua going forward. He's the one with the hair.
Is that because you can't pronounce his last name?
No, it's Komisarjevsky. But would you like me to spell it for you?
No.
Okay.
Being really defensive right now.
I just don't, like, I can say it. I'm choosing not to because it's a ridiculous last name and he's a ridiculous man.
Okay.
So Joshua Andrew Komisarjevsky was born in Torrington, Connecticut in August 1980. He was put up for adoption by his 16-year-old mother who was impregnated by a mechanic who was, quote, barely out of his teens. Don't know what that means, but feels like he probably shouldn't be having sex with a 16-year-old. Just me. So Benedict and Judy? It's spelled Jude, but it's a woman. Judy? Komisarzewski adopted Joshua when he was just 2 weeks old. As a child, Joshua was sexually abused by an individual who possibly could have been a foster child that had been living with the family. Not really sure who sexually abused him, just that he was sexually abused. And when I say not really sure, I mean nobody. So he was sexually abused at the age of 4 to 6. So for those years, as well as being tortured and burnt. In the early 1990s, Joshua's sister accused him of assaulting her. He was convicted of that assault, but he was like 10 or 11, so I don't think anything really happened there. But his dad did say in court that it was most likely true. When Joshua was 14, he started a career in burglary. In 2002, when he was 22 years old, he was arrested for 18 home invasions. Joshua could remember each and every one he committed with perfect detail. He told his attorney that after he finished robbing the house, he'd go to the bedrooms where the occupants slept and just listen to them breathe. Is that off-putting? It feels off-putting to me.
Mm-hmm. No.
Feels like a stepping stone towards serial killer.
I mean, yeah.
Any input from Lacey? Don't stand
over me and watch me breathe.
I don't like it.
What did I say?
I don't know. I'm sorry.
Joshua, at the age of 14, started his burglary career. By 2002. Joshua. Huh?
Which one's Joshua, Lacey?
It's the younger one. It's the one with the hair.
Good
girl. He was adopted, and then he was abused, and then he abused his sister.
Yes.
I didn't catch all that. It was just like the last 2 minutes.
In 2002, when he was 22, he was arrested for 18 home invasions.
Wow.
He remembered each one with perfect detail, and he told his attorney that his MO was he would rob the house, and then he would go to the bedrooms where people were sleeping and just watch them sleep so that he could listen to them breathe.
Oh, so I was right. I don't like that.
Yeah. You were right, but you didn't know why.
I didn't know what I didn't like, but yeah, no.
But I wanted to share that with you because it's important going forward.
Okay.
I
don't like that either.
He said he did this because he enjoyed the feeling of invading people's homes and violating their security.
That feels so self-aware that it's scary.
Yeah, like he knows why he's doing it.
Yes. He's like, I'm very aware that I'm a creep and I want to invade people's privacy and shit.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like that.
In December of 2002, he was convicted of 12 counts of burglary and sentenced to 9 years in prison. The sentencing judge described Joshua as being a calculated, cold-blooded predator. He was paroled in April 2007. The parole board never received the transcript from the sentencing proceeding, which they should have under Connecticut law. But they never did, so they weren't aware of how creepy he was and how...
when they didn't receive it, why shouldn't they have been like, hey, we didn't get the transcript, we need that to do our parole work?
Yeah. I kind of got the impression that they were just like, well, he's in front of us, let's just
do it.
You know how it's like in court, if they don't have the evidence to submit, then well.
Yeah.
Like Judge Judy always says, where do you think you were coming today? The beach?
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have it, then it doesn't exist. Huh. Maybe it was like that.
That's annoying.
Yes.
Bless you.
Gesundheit.
Jesus.
Oh, God.
So they weren't aware of all the details regarding the case. So they approved his parole, which, just to remind you, was in April of 2007. And Michaela and Jennifer were being creeped on at the end of July 2007.
Oh, interesting.
After being paroled, Joshua stayed at the Silliman House, the Silliman Halfway House, where he met Stephen Joseph Hayes. Stephen Joseph Hayes is the bald man. He was born at the end of May in 1963. He described his childhood as not particularly happy, but normal. His father, James, really wanted a daughter, and he would remind his wife and sons about this fact often, and how James felt that they were all just, you know, inadequate.
Okay.
Why do you want a daughter that bad?
Yeah, that's my question
too. And like bad enough for it to be something you hold on to for years and like make your other kids feel shitty about.
Yeah.
Not also, even a little bit of, oh, I wanted a girl, and you're like a little bit disappointed, but like
at the gender reveal you're sad. But then you move on because you meet the baby and you're like, oh, pretty cool.
Yeah, I like this one.
But no, also, he held on to it for years.
It's his fault he doesn't have a girl.
Exactly. Yeah. I love when the men try and blame other people.
Yeah. It was you. That's not how genetics work. Mm-hmm. Fuck you.
Yeah, fuck you.
School records show that he was recommended for special education classes due to his immature speech and behavior, short attention span, eating inedibles, and instigating trouble.
Eating inedibles?
Yeah, you know, like pencils, paper, erasers. I don't know. What do kids eat?
They see?
Usually edible stuff, but he did a different thing. So.
That's a good point. When Hayes was 10 years old, his parents divorced, probably for the best. Hayes would soon turn to alcohol and have run-ins with the law. He was convicted of burglary for the first time in 1980 at the age of 16. Hayes was tried as an adult at that time, but paroled in 1982. However, 7 weeks later, guess who violated their parole?
Oh.
Tough question. Hayes?
Yes.
Good answer.
Thank you.
Between his paroled date and the summer of 2007, Hayes was arrested almost 30 times.
Jesus.
He's
trying to go for a record, or?
I don't know. He spent those 25 years in and out of prison, and in 2004, Hayes was arrested after smashing a car window with a rock and stealing a purse. In 2006, Hayes was paroled and sent to the Silliman House. So, in July 2007, Hayes was 44, Joshua was 26. After Joshua followed the Petites home, he and Hayes made a plan to rob the home under the cover of darkness, because they both had a history in
burglary.
Robbing. Burglary. Robbing, Lacey. So silly.
They're good at it.
You know, don't do the thing that you're good at and you love the most in the world.
Yeah. I'm chomping at the bit to get started. Need a margarita soon.
So, text messages between the two indicated that they were eager.
Remember when texts used to look like this?
Yeah.
Well.
So, if you
hold your horses.
He said, "We still on?" And he said, "Yes, I'm putting kid to bed. Hold your horses." Apparently.
Didn't they live in the same house?
So. Yes, but apparently Joshua had a child.
Okay.
I couldn't find any information other than these text messages about it.
I don't like that.
And I just assumed that he was, like, putting that kid to bed and then he was going to go back to his halfway house. Mm. I don't know. Their plan was they were going to tie up everybody in the house, then steal everything. Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot. There's one more set of text messages. Boop.
the horses want to get loose, LOL?
They're speaking in code.
And he said, hold your horses. The horses want to get loose.
Oh!
And then somebody said they wanted a margarita.
Check this out.
Some fun guys planning tonight's robbing.
Yep.
I can get a margarita with them.
I don't think we should.
Yeah.
I think we're going to learn some stuff about them. That's going to make us not want to have a margarita with them.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't.
I've already learned some stuff about them that I don't love.
That night, Michaela cooked Sunday dinner for her family, and Dr. Petit fell asleep reading the paper while the girls watched television and headed off to bed. Around 3 a.m. on July 23rd, 2007, punched my mic.
She's getting excited.
Hayes and Joshua returned to the Petit home. They skulked around the exterior.
What's a skulk?
That's how I imagine them.
Great. Thank you. That was pretty good, actually. Like a cartoon villain.
Yeah, exactly. They skulked around the exterior, noticed Dr. Williams sleeping on a couch in the sunroom, and realized that he'd have to be subdued first. So Joshua entered the basement through an unlocked door. He grabbed a baseball bat he had found leaning on the stairs, and then he snuck up into the sunroom. He stood over Dr. Petit for 15 to 20 seconds, debating whether or not to strike him, while Hayes, who was still outside, was motioning for Joshua to hit him.
Well, Joshua also probably got distracted because he liked watching people sleep. Yeah,
I was thinking that too. I think he was probably just like listening to the breathing and enjoying himself.
This is calming. Finding my center.
Joshua hit him in the head a multiple of times. 4 to 5 to be exact. Mm-hmm. With the bat until Dr. William was huddled in the corner of the couch. Joshua then unlocked the exterior door of the sunroom so that Hayes could come inside, and together they tied Dr. Petit's wrists and ankles with plastic zip ties and rope. Dr. Petit remembers that one of the men, he's not sure which, had said, if he moves, put 2 bullets in him. They Dr. asked Petit him...
lived?
Yes.
Uh-oh.
They asked him who else was in the house. Dr. Petit told the intruders his wife, Jennifer, and his 2 daughters, Michaela and Haley, were upstairs. Jennifer was 48, Michaela 11, and Haley was 17. The men went upstairs to the master bedroom to find Jennifer and Michaela asleep. Joshua approached Michaela while Hayes approached Jennifer. They tied their hands behind their back and their feet together. They did the same to Haley before returning to Jennifer to ask where the cash was. She told them they didn't have any cash in the house, but she offered her jewelry. The men then separated all 3 females, putting them in a room alone with pillowcases on their heads, and tied them to beds. Then they spent hours just ransacking the home. So they entered at around 3 a.m., as the sun started to rise, the men started to, I don't want to say panic, but they were just like, shit. What, with the sun comes light, and with light people can see.
Good thought process.
Yeah. They realized that they would have to move their truck from where they parked it. Mm-hmm. So they collected the phones from the house. They unplugged the landline and all that stuff. And then they left. Joshua drove his truck to a condo complex while Hayes followed behind in the Petit family home. Nope, that's not true. He didn't bring the home house. He just brought the car.
Okay.
Hayes then drove Joshua back to the house. They moved William to the basement and tied him to a support pole so neighbors wouldn't be able to see him through the sunroom windows. Joshua... Okay, so hold on real quick. Here's the bat. There's the bag of zip ties. And then this is the basement door that they entered through. Here's some clothes, gloves, more gloves. Okay. Joshua made a little seat for William on the floor with couch pillows. So that's where Dr. William was tied up. Do you think it's interesting that Joshua made a pillow for him? A little bed?
I'm surprised that he cared enough to.
They continued searching for money. Joshua checked in on the girls, made sure that they got bathroom breaks when they needed to, and offered them water. Joshua spent a lot of time with Michaela, talking to her about music and stuff. They asked the family if they had jobs they were expected to be at in the morning. Jennifer was off for the summer because, as you remember, she was a school nurse. But Dr. Petit was expected at the hospital for rounds. However, because he had such intense head injuries, he was unable to make a coherent phone call. So Jennifer was forced to call his work and tell them that William was sick and wouldn't be in today. So the only thing that they found of interest to them was a check register, which I Googled, and it's like a checkbook where they used to track withdrawals, deposits.
Yeah.
The check register indicated that the Petites had about $40,000 in the bank. So, always thinking on their feet, the men made a new plan. The men told Jennifer that if she were to withdraw $15,000 from the bank, they would not hurt her or the family. So she agreed, but they needed to wait until the bank was open. So as they were waiting, Hayes began to grow more and more paranoid. He started worrying about DNA evidence being inside the home, which, yeah, you've been all throughout the house. Like, you've been in the car. Like, it's all over the place. So he told Joshua that he wanted to burn the house down to destroy any forensics. Before, like, they didn't really have a conversation. Hayes just grabbed two large bottles from the garage, stole their car again, and drove to a gas station. Surveillance footage from the Cheshire Citgo station shows Hayes purchasing $10 worth of gas in two bottles around 7 a.m. In case you're wondering, $10 back in 2007 was like 3 gallons. It really wasn't that much. Gas prices were like $2.60 back then, so really. Anyway, Hayes returned 20 minutes later and told Joshua that they had to burn the house down and kill the family. As 9 a.m. approached, Stephen Hayes took Jennifer to the bank while Joshua stayed behind with the children and Dr. William. Their surveillance footage from the bank shows Jennifer approaching the teller at 9:09 a.m. She is alone speaking to the teller, but she tells the woman that she needs the money because two men are holding her family hostage. She asks the teller not to call the police, but she must have thought she was so close to, like, just getting these men away from her family. Like, don't call the police, just give me the money and they'll leave. Like, the bank teller told Jennifer that she wouldn't call police, but she told the manager, Mary Lyons, who was like, fuck that. So yeah. Mary called the police and spoke to the dispatcher as Jennifer and Hayes drove out of the parking lot a little bit before 9:30. Mary told the dispatcher that Jennifer had indicated that the home invaders were being nice and that she believed they only wanted money. Meanwhile, back at the house, Joshua was still chatting with 11-year-old Michaela. They spoke about summer plans. Then, in Joshua's own words, one thing led to another. Joshua sexually assaulted 11-year-old Michaela Petit. He used scissors to cut off her clothing, took pictures of her with his cell phone, and then he raped her. The Cheshire Police responded to the bank's report by assessing the situation. They set up a perimeter around the house, but did not want to reveal their presence. Hayes and Jennifer returned back to the house, and Jennifer was tied up again and left in the living room. At this time, Hayes began to sexually assault Jennifer. Because why the fuck not? William was able to hear his wife's assault upstairs, because he was just, like, in the basement. He yelled up and heard one of the invaders say, "Don't worry, it's all going to be over in a couple minutes." William then managed to escape. He freed his hands and he crawled out of the basement. Joshua heard the door to the basement open, and he saw Dr. Petit was hopping and crawling across the yard towards a neighbor's house, yelling for help. Joshua ran to the living room where Hayes was still assaulting Jennifer and informed him that William had escaped. In response to that, Hayes strangled Jennifer to death.
Ugh.
Then doused her body in gasoline. The men then poured gasoline in various parts of the house, including the girls' bedrooms and the girls themselves. They then started a fire.
Well, the girls were still alive?
Yeah. So, it was close to 10 a.m. William was crawling to his neighbor, who didn't even recognize him due to the severe head injuries. Police made a radio dispatch at 9:54 a.m., indicating that there was someone calling for help in the Petit backyard. At this time, Stephen Hayes and Joshua Komisarzewski peeled out of the driveway in Jennifer's SUV. Police immediately pursued them, and the two made it. Guess how far they made it?
1 mile.
1 block.
Jesus.
Not a great escape. Before crashing into a police cruiser. They were promptly arrested, just as the smoke began to rise from the rear of the house. It was at this time that the fire department was called. When fire arrived on scene, the house was fully ablaze. Inside, Haley had managed to escape her restraints. Oh, real quick. There's Dr. Petit in the hospital. Jesus. Haley managed to escape her restraints and flee her bedroom, but succumbed to smoke inhalation and collapsed at the top of the stairs. When she was found, she had first, second, and third degree burns all over her body. The medical examiner could not determine if the burns occurred before or after her death. Michaela, too, died from smoke inhalation. She was found in her bedroom, still in bed. Her hands were still tied to the bed, but her lower body was hanging off of it. Michaela also sustained burns, but again, the ME was unable to determine at what point the burns occurred. So at the time of their arrest, Hayes had a BB gun, while Joshua was unarmed. The men had gone to Walmart together before the home invasion, so Hayes could purchase the gun. Both Hayes and Joshua confessed to the murders. Detectives noted that Hayes smelled of gasoline throughout the interrogation, and each of them claimed that the other was the mastermind behind the home invasion. But Joshua also blamed William.
Why?
In his diary, Joshua called William a coward and claimed that he could have saved his family if he really wanted to.
Okay.
I feel like that's the epitome of victim blaming.
Yeah.
Yeah. We beat you and tied you up, but if you wanted to save your family, you'd have figured it out.
Joshua also confessed to assaulting Michaela, although he said he thought she was 14 or 16. So,
that makes it better.
So it was okay. He claimed he took pictures of her just to send to Hayes.
Okay.
So his story was that Hayes told... There are text messages between Hayes and Joshua while Hayes was at the bank. Hayes was like waiting in the car in the parking lot while Jennifer was in the bank, and Hayes messaged Joshua because he was still paranoid. He was like, she's not coming out. Shit's going to, like, this isn't going to work. We're going to get fucked. So Joshua said that he sent the pictures of Michaela to Hayes so that Hayes could show Jennifer and be like, don't forget why you're doing this. That was his story.
Does he think that makes it better? Like, does he think that's a reasonable,
I guess, he thinks that
for having the pictures?
He's like being like, I wasn't using it for my own gratification.
You just used her body for your own gratification.
Yeah, you still raped her.
Got it.
Hayes, on the other hand, told police that Joshua had provoked him into raping Jennifer. I would like to, like, how? What? In his confession, Hayes said that when he and Jennifer arrived back from the bank, Joshua told Hayes he had to get his hands dirty. Following the arrest, Hayes had written letters claiming that he would have killed Joshua if the police had not arrested them. He had also written he killed 17 William. He had also written he killed 17 women and took their sneakers as trophies.
What?
So he's just like claiming that he's a serial killer.
Okay. But he took their sneakers as trophies?
Yeah.
Okay.
Dr. Susan Williams was an associate medical examiner for the state's ME's office when she performed Jennifer's autopsy. She described Jennifer as being burned beyond recognition and had to be identified through dental records. Jennifer still had ligatures on her ankles and wrists when her body was brought in for the autopsy. She had no traces of carbon monoxide in her body, nor soot in her airways. But Dr. Williams noted larynx fractures and thus ruled the cause of death as asphyxiation via manual strangulation. Dr. Williams said that it would have taken 8 to 15 seconds for her to lose consciousness while being strangled. It's a long time. Lacey's been quiet.
Mm-hmm. I don't like them.
Okay. Great input.
Thank you.
Thought I missed her.
Thank you.
Dr. Malka Shah was an associate medical examiner for the state's ME's office when she performed Haley's autopsy. Dr. Shah noted that Haley's right wrist had traces of a rope tie and portions of rope were tied to one of her ankles. Shaw also noticed an aroma of petroleum on her clothing. Haley had an extensive amount of soot in her lungs and throat. 53% of the oxygen carrying capacity of Haley's blood was filled with carbon monoxide. Any level above 30 to 50% is usually fatal. So, the ME noted that it took 2 to several minutes for Haley to die, though she may have been unconscious for a portion of that time. Michaela's autopsy was performed by the actual state chief medical examiner, Dr. H. Wayne Carver II. Semen belonging to Joshua was found in her body. Like her sister, Michaela had soot in her airway, indicating that she was alive when the fire was started. Forensic testing results showed that there was bleach on Michaela's clothing, indicating that Joshua may have tried to eliminate DNA evidence from the assault. Traces of gasoline were found on the girls' beds and on their clothing. So, did Joshua just, like, pour bleach on her? An idiot. John Farnham was the computer crime unit. John Farnham of the computer crime unit at the state forensics lab was able to retrieve 8 photos from Joshua's cell phone. The first 2 were graphic photos of Joshua taken the night before the home invasion. So just, you know, some selfies. Some dick pics. The first The following five photos were taken between 7:27 and 8:09 a.m., showing Michaela tied to her bed. The final photo showed an older female lying on her back at 9:14 a.m. Farnham was the one who retrieved the text messages between Hayes and Joshua. So, the times are interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because, first, I mean, like, if he's saying that he took photos of Michaela to use as leverage against Jennifer, she was in the bank at 9:09 to 9:30. Why did he take the photos at 7:27 and 8:09? And then also, Jennifer was at the bank. And the last photo was of an older female lying on her back at 9:14. So did he also take pictures of Haley?
Yeah.
Both men were charged with multiple counts, including murder, sexual assault, arson, and kidnapping. Stephen Hayes' trial began first with... Real quick, before we get into that, I just want to show you. Look at them.
I don't like it.
Hayes goes through a whole thing.
He looks like he found, like...
Jesus?
Yeah, but he's wearing, like, he went Muslim.
Type thing. Yeah. So Stephen Hayes' trial began first with jury selection in January 2010. Due to the amount of medical attention, finding an impartial jury took months. Additionally, they also moved the venue to New Haven, Connecticut because of the publicity. So, jury selection began in January. Opening statements began on September 13th, 2010. Michael Darrington was the lead prosecutor for the state, while Thomas Ullman was the lead on Hayes' defense team. The prosecution focused their case on the brutality of the crime, forensic evidence, and the timeline of events. Their strategy was to establish premeditation and describe the horrific nature of the crimes to secure the death penalty. Meanwhile, the defense took an unusual approach. Ullman admitted Hayes was guilty early on in the trial. Okay. He told the jury that Hayes was responsible for the crimes, but in an effort to save Hayes from the death penalty, the defense team argued that Hayes was manipulated by Joshua.
Mm-hmm.
They tried to portray Hayes as a deeply troubled, suicidal man, coerced by Joshua, and overwhelmed by his circumstances. They emphasized that he had mental health issues, a history of drug abuse, and claims that he wanted to die.
Okay.
Reportedly, he did try to commit suicide in custody before the trial. But the trial was relatively quick as a result, because so the defense didn't spend much time trying to disprove the prosecution's case, so it took less than a month.
Mm-hmm.
On October 5th, 2010, the jury deliberated for 4 hours. They came back into the courtroom and it was announced that they had found Stephen Hayes guilty on all 16 counts. The sentencing phase lasted 4 days, beginning November 5th. The jury had to weigh aggravating factors like the cruelty of the crimes against mitigating factors like Hayes's troubled past and mental health issues. The troubled past presented by the defense in an effort to persuade the jury to choose life imprisonment over the death penalty included several things. And now I'm going to read them to you, and I want you to let me know if you feel like they...
In the beginning, didn't you say that Hayes had, like, an alright childhood, just wasn't happy?
Yeah, he said he had a happy childhood. Or he said it wasn't happy, but it was normal.
Okay, where's this troubled past that we're talking about?
Okay. So, the defense told the jury that Hayes had a severe drug addiction to crack cocaine and heroin.
Okay.
And at the time of the crimes, Hayes was in a desperate, drug-fueled state.
Okay.
They also said that Hayes grew up in a highly dysfunctional, abusive home. His father was reportedly physically abusive, and his childhood was marked by instability. Hayes had a documented history of mental health struggles, including depression and suicidal tendencies. He had previously attempted suicide while awaiting trial, and some reports mentioned antisocial personality traits. The defense argued that Hayes had below average intellectual functioning, which impaired his judgment and decision-making. They also said that he was manipulated or heavily influenced by Joshua, who they claimed was the more dominant and sadistic partner in the crime.
Back to the beginning one, where he was, like, in a drug-needed state, right? Is that what you said?
Drug-fueled. Yeah.
Okay. People that are, like, trying to get more drugs or, like, money for drugs and go to, like, burglary, don't spend hours and hours in a house with a family. They don't need cash. They'll take anything.
I don't think that the defense was arguing that he was there trying to find money for drugs. I think that he was saying that he couldn't think logically
because he was in a drug state. Okay, but
I mean, it would explain the paranoia, but, you know, I don't think any of this warrants him getting off.
No.
Also,
he was still, like, thinking, they were still thinking, like, clearly while they were there, or, like, methodically, like, oh, I need gasoline to burn the house down.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I need to take her to the bank to get money.
They were worried about forensics and stuff.
Like, that's okay. What do you think of those excuses, Lacey?
I think that they're absurd. Mm-hmm. I don't even understand why they didn't just plead guilty and skip the whole trial. And it's all stupid.
Because he probably didn't want to.
Yeah. I feel like the defense attorneys probably were like, please.
Yeah.
Please, like, buddy, you don't want to take this to trial.
All of this work.
And he was like, no, I can fix this.
The thing I don't get is, like, they're bringing up his mental health, but are they using the fact that, like, Andrew mentioned, like, oh, well, like, he tried to commit suicide, like, once, like, while in custody. Okay, was he suicidal before he was caught?
Right. Was he suicidal before he went and, like, tortured and killed his family?
Or was he just suicidal because he didn't want to go to prison?
Yeah.
Or back to prison. Oh, hello,
context matters.
Why is she so sleepy? Oh, big yawn. Oh, she good girl.
Hi, baby.
Also, isn't Hayes, like, older than Joshua?
I thought so. Like, I don't remember how old they were, but I remember, like, I mean, this picture also, they look very different.
Yeah.
The first picture we saw of the two of them, he looked older. I actually thought at first when she was telling us about Joshua and his upbringing, I thought that the other guy in the picture was his father.
Oh. Or,
you know, adopted father, whatever. Because it felt like there was enough of an age gap in the picture.
Bless you. Sorry, Sylvia just sneezed.
Oh, bless you.
Mm. Yeah, it's like, how did he manipulate you?
Right. It's so stupid. I feel like, too, if we know that they both did it, it doesn't even matter, like, who the mastermind is. It doesn't matter who started the plan or whatever. Like, you both were willing participants.
We also have text messages before the crime. You're both excited. Oh,
yeah. Yeah.
Like, what?
Excited, ready to get your margarita afterwards.
It's not, the horses wanted to come loose.
Yeah, the horses were ready.
So, the defense, or Hayes, in his statements, actually said that Joshua was the one who was escalating the situation. And the defense argued that Hayes showed genuine remorse for his actions. He expressed in both court and in private conversations with his lawyers that he wished to die because of the guilt he felt.
Oh, let him. That's a shame.
Hayes had expressed a wish to die, viewing the death penalty almost as a form of suicide. His lawyers argued this showed psychological instability rather than a cold-blooded calculation. So, you know, don't kill him.
I feel like he just is upset that he got caught and he doesn't know. Like, he's mad. Not mad, but he's, like, scared now.
Yeah. I mean, he's been in and out of prison for 25 years, but I feel like he didn't want to die.
Yeah.
So he's like, if I ask him, maybe reverse psychology?
Mm. I feel like it's not that hard to play remorseful.
Mm-hmm.
You just say, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, for the defense, on November 8th, 2010, the jury returned with the unanimous decision for the death penalty.
Nice.
For context, the sentencing phase usually takes days or weeks in a death penalty case, but here, they were done in under 20 hours of deliberation. When both decisions were read, both times, Hayes sat mostly expressionless. Which, you know,
that shows remorse.
Yeah, he felt real sad. Stephen Hayes was originally sent to the Connecticut's death row at Northern Correctional Institution in Somers, Connecticut. In comparison, Joshua's reaction to his verdict and sentence was notably different. Joshua Komisarzewski went on trial beginning with jury selection in March 2011. Again, this took many months, and opening statements began on September 19th, 2011, so like a year after Hayes. Again, Michael Darrington was the lead prosecutor for the state, but Joshua had Walter Bansley III as his lead defense attorney. Again, the prosecution strategy was to show premeditation, sadism, and control, and to emphasize Joshua's role in escalating the violence. The defense took a different route than the first defense team. Bansley tried to paint Joshua as a damaged, troubled man under the influence of Hayes. So instead of accepting guilt and relying on mitigating factors, this defense team tried to shift the blame and focused heavily on Joshua's psychological trauma. Do you think that their tactic worked?
No.
I think it has a better shot than Hayes.
You don't think just walking into court and saying, he did it, but here's why. You don't think that's a good way?
No.
The prosecution called around 50 witnesses, and the defense called just a few. They called police, firefighters, forensic experts, bank employees, gas station employees, and even Joshua's ex-girlfriend, who helped the prosecution portray him as manipulative and controlling. The defense called Joshua's family, psychological experts, and a religious counselor.
They called a religious counselor?
Yeah, he basically just testified saying Joshua had found Jesus.
Okay.
His family testified to his troubled upbringing, painting a portrait of a boy failed by the system. The psych experts testified about medical records showing Joshua had suffered at least 5 concussions as a child, and they also testified about his abuse, mental health struggles, drug abuse. He favored crystal methamphetamine, as well as him having PTSD and poor impulse control. In the end, the prosecution painted Joshua as the mastermind who selected the victims, stalked the family, and set the events in motion. He wasn't a passive follower. They said he was the one who escalated things. He broke into the house. He photographed Michaela in obscene ways, and he relayed updates to Hayes. Quote, "This was not a man under another's control. This was a man enjoying what he was doing."
Mm-hmm.
The defense portrayed Joshua as an emotionally unstable, impulsive man who never meant for the night to end in murder.
Well, it
but
did,
how did
so.
He mean the end the night?
I don't know. I feel like they may have been like, look, he got him a seat. He chatted with Michaela for hours. He got them water. He let them go pee.
he selected this family after seeing Michaela. Like,
He also, you know, beat Dr. William with a bat.
Shh, gloss over that.
And if he was controlled by Hayes, when Hayes left, why didn't he just, like, leave too?
He was scared. God, Drew, you don't understand the fear.
I mean, Hayes does have a look. Creepy old man.
Yeah.
The prosecution's strongest piece of evidence was Joshua's diary. He had kept it while in custody and graphically described the attack. If you remember from the beginning, he was able to remember his break-ins to the, like, every detail he got right. So, that's why in the diary, graphically described the attacks. He referred to the Petit family.
Oh,
sorry. He referred to the Petit family home as a lair of pure chaos. And he showed zero remorse for his actions in parts of his diary. He described photographing Michaela in vulgar, horrifying terms. And later, jurors said that the prosecution reading excerpts aloud made it impossible to believe Joshua was just a follower.
Good.
Throughout the trial, Joshua often appeared more animated than Hayes. He took notes, he whispered with his lawyers, he even spoke during his sentencing phase, apologizing to Dr. Petit. He said, "The loss of your family will always be with me."
Oh, he ought to be allowed a couple minutes alone in a room with him.
He apologized to him after, didn't he say that he could have saved his family if he just tried harder?
Yeah, you know. Yeah,
but I'm sorry.
Joshua was the one who was like, William, like, was a bit of a coward. He just ran out of the house. Like, he should have stayed behind and saved his family.
But my bad. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Your family will be with me. In the end,
I hope not.
Right? Or if they are, I hope they're haunting him.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, the jury deliberated for 5 days, returning a guilty verdict on October 13th, 2011. I thought it was interesting that this jury took 5 days while the other one took only 4 hours.
Yeah. Maybe because they actually, like, I don't know, had, like, more evidence to go over and, like, the psychological stuff.
Maybe they read his entire diary.
Yeah.
Joshua Kamizarjarski was found guilty of 17 counts, including murder, kidnapping, arson, and sexual assault of Michaela Petit. The sentencing hearing began on October 24th, and the jury began deliberations on November 7th. After 5 hours, the jury sentenced Joshua to death by lethal injection. Official sentencing by the judge happened in January the following year, formally imposing the death penalty based on the jury's decision. When the jury sentenced Joshua to death, he was visibly emotional, much more so than Hayes had been. As the verdict was read, Joshua hung his head and appeared to wipe away tears. Courtroom witnesses described him as being visibly shaken. His body language was slumped, and he avoided eye contact with the jury and spectators. Unlike Hayes, who was almost eerily calm, Joshua showed signs of distress and sadness.
Good.
And then just to a little note here. During both trials, the police received a lot of shit for seemingly being
just
responding lackadaisically to the report of a family being held hostage. The police defended their actions, blaming state protocol and the fact that they had no report of violence. Jennifer hadn't seen William, so they were like, the report we got said that the hostage takers were being nice and only wanted money. So how are we to know that they were going to kill people? And Jennifer hadn't seen William because she was up in the bedroom. And then when they left the house, he had been moved to the basement. So, like, as far as she knows, nobody was hurt. Still, though.
But you have a family that's being held hostage in their house.
Yeah.
You don't think a threat of violence has been, like, thrown out there or anything?
Captain Robert Vignola testified that the information from the start was very confusing. He was establishing a rescue team at the time that the fire was set and all that shit. But, like, so the reason people thought it was odd that the fire department wasn't on scene already.
Well, how did they know there was a fire going to be happening?
True, but they should have had, like, EMS there. But again, they didn't know that there was any violence being taken place, so.
But you should still be, like, checking out people when they're getting...
Anyway. No, yeah, I was being sarcastic. They should had EMS there, because even if the hostages were fine, you still need them to be checked out. And usually, EMS and fire are holding hands. Aww. People were just like, if fire had been on the scene, the fire would not have gotten so bad, and maybe... I mean, Jennifer was strangled before the fire started, but the daughters could have been saved.
Yeah.
Like Stephen Hayes, Joshua Camizzo... God, I can't say his name anymore. Joshua was originally held at Northern Correctional Institution in Somers, Connecticut on death row.
Death row.
Unfortunately, in 2015, Connecticut abolished the death penalty.
Son of a bitch.
And both men's sentences were officially commuted to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
Can we transfer them to Texas?
No.
Tell us
why. But they have been transferred. After some time, Hayes complained about the conditions at Northern CI, saying that they were just unbearable.
Ugh. It's so hard when prison is just so boring and you have to share space.
In 2016, both men were transferred. Hayes was moved to a federal prison, the United States Penitentiary in Allenwood in PA. He requested this move because, you know, the other one was just too bad.
Why are they able to request moves?
I think that they moved him, and then he was like, oh, this is actually great. I wanted this. This is what I asked for.
Okay. You said he's in PA. We still have the death penalty, don't we?
I don't know. Hayes has since referred to, I think because his trial was in Connecticut.
That's bullshit.
Yeah. Hayes has since referred to life at the federal prison in Pennsylvania as luxurious compared to Connecticut's death row.
Send him back to Connecticut.
Right? Joshua was sent to the United States Penitentiary in Indiana. He was transferred for safety reasons and to alleviate conditions at Northern CI. So I think that they were just overcrowded and they were just sending people out. And the last thing I'm going to say about these two dickholes. In early 2019, Stephen Hayes began identifying as transgender and took the name Linda Hayes. This is the most recent picture of the two of them.
Okay.
Following the invasion and murders, Dr. Petit was taken to the hospital to be evaluated. He suffered multiple skull fractures and had deep lacerations to his head and face. Though it wasn't officially confirmed as severe brain trauma, the extent of the assault strongly suggested he suffered at least a concussion.
At least.
He was in intensive care for several days. He was released from the hospital after about 2 weeks, physically stable, but still with significant pain, headaches, and weakness from blood loss. Eventually, the wounds healed, but he still suffers from chronic pain, nerve sensitivity, and headaches. Years later, William has spoken about dealing with survivor's guilt, PTSD, nightmares, and flashbacks. He says, the wounds heal, the head heals, the heart and the soul, those take a lifetime. Mm-hmm. Speaking of survivor's guilt, can you imagine, like, it must be so strong for him.
Yeah.
Because, like, not only did he survive, like, he escaped. And, like,
yeah.
So the shit that, like, Joshua was saying about how he should have saved his family, I bet he's just saying that in his own head.
Yeah.
Like, what would have changed if he, like, went upstairs instead of just out of the house?
Nothing. I agree. Well, yeah. The thing that would have changed is he would have died, too. But, like, he's got to... I mean, he's like, I imagine that he's like, I should have done something.
Yeah.
Later, he recalls, I went to sleep one night in a nice home with a loving family and basically awakened in an emergency room, naked on a gurney with no clothes, no family, and no home. Mm-hmm. Everything was gone. Dr. Petit did not return to practicing medicine after losing his family. He founded the Petit Family Foundation, which supports education, especially of women in science, people affected by chronic illnesses, because of his wife's MS, and assistance to victims of violence. In 2012, he remarried to Christine Palouf, a photographer whom he met when she was volunteering for the Petit Foundation. Together, they had a son in November 2013, William Arthur Petit III. In 2016, in the 2016 election, he won the election to the Connecticut House of Representatives from the 22nd District, and again won in 2018 and 2020. However, he decided to not run again in 2022. So he left medicine and is now a politician.
Hmm.
I have a question for you guys.
Yes.
On this gravestone, Dr. Williams' name is on it, along with Jennifer and her two daughters. Do you think when he goes, is he going to be buried there or with his new wife and child?
I think probably there.
I mean, I feel like gravesites are really expensive, so don't waste a gravesite. You know?
I think he'll be there. That was his first family.
Yeah, but, like, then his wife is going to be all alone.
She has the son.
Yeah.
But what if the son wants to be married?
She could have a family plot or something where she's going to be, like, with her parents or
something.
That's
true. I was imagining she was an orphan.
But also, I mean, and this might just be my morbidism of it, but, like, you get reunited in heaven. Like, doesn't matter where you get buried. So he'll have his first wife and his second wife in heaven with all of his kids.
I just remember, it was Modern Family when Sofia Vergara and Jay were talking about how, like, he's probably going to die first. Where is she going to be buried? So it reminded me of that conversation.
I don't really have this thought because I'm going to be cremated.
Same.
Yeah.
I plan on sitting on someone's mantle watching.
Oh, me too. Should we sit next to each other?
No, I'm going to be in one of my kids' homes. Unless Aunt Bailey is hanging out there. Get your own.
Should we make it?
Maybe all the cousins can take turns passing their aunts and their moms around.
Should we mix our bodies together. That they need to bring us for Christmas and everything.
Yeah.
I still want to attend.
I want to be.
You can do kind of they can do some kind of a Christmas thing every year where, like, you know, like the pickle gift thing for Christmas that some people do where, like, you have the pickle ornament on the tree and whoever finds it first, like, whichever kid finds it first, they get, like, a present that's just for that.
So they get our urn for the year?
Yeah.
Well, not a pickle, we could just be part of the Yankee swap.
Ooh.
Nobody wants Mom and Aunt Bailey. Keep swapping. Well, that was sinister.
And we were sarcastic.
And we hope you keep listening.